Why Las Vegas was not terrorism, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Some people want President Trump to call the Las Vegas shooter a terrorist. Author Masha Gessen tells me why she disagrees.
We shouldn't try to imbue the violence with meaning.
Also, the U.S. pulls diplomats out of Cuba and warns tourists about traveling there. Ordinary Cubans don't get it.
Seems to them a huge overreaction, and of course one that will impact those small businesses, the entrepreneurs that President Trump says he wants to help.
Plus, the former FBI agent who's tackling his toughest cold case. Who betrayed Anne Frank and her family?
We have a motto on the team, and that there is no statute of limitations on the truth. Doesn't matter how long it takes, we're going to try to solve this.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on this Wednesday. Every day we track what's happening around the globe, and this week, after Las Vegas, it's the globe that's tracking what's happening here in the U.S. So that's on our radar, gun violence in America, and the ongoing conversations about what to do about it. And those conversations are not just about guns.
Actually, I would love it if we just stopped using the word terrorist and terrorism. I think it would complicate the conversation, which is very good. I think it would force us to re-examine the rhetoric and the tactics of the war on terrorism, which would be even better.
That's New Yorker writer Masha Gessen. Her latest book is called The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. We talked about that when she came by our studio today, but I want to focus here on an essay she wrote yesterday in The New Yorker. In it, Gessen argues that what Stephen Paddock did in Las Vegas on Sunday night does not fit many definitions of terrorism.
Basically, terrorism experts agree that an act of terror has to pursue a political objective, and the person or persons attacked shouldn't be the direct opponents of the attacker, right? They're usually symbolic victims, and the violence is meant to send a message to the larger society. So the Las Vegas shooting doesn't seem to have pursued a political objective. And I also in the essay refer to Charlottesville, where right after Charlottesville, if you remember, there was that scene outside of Trump Tower when a reporter was yelling at Trump, basically demanding that Trump call it terrorism. And that act of violence, I don't think was terrorism because it was politically motivated, certainly, but it was a direct attack on the counter-protesters, right? It wasn't a symbolic victim. So, but to me, even the use of language is a lesser point than what it stands for, which is that, you know, I think that there's a dream that once he calls it terrorism, we will take mass shootings and white masculinist violence more seriously, the way that we take terrorism seriously. And that, I think, is the really tragic and dangerous part, because I think we're fighting terrorism all wrong. And if we start fighting mass shootings the same way, it will not improve the situation.
So, I mean, it wasn't just that reporter outside of Trump Tower asking for the word, but a lot of people are. So you think the desire for that is rooted in some belief that if the word is used, there will be a solution to follow.
Exactly. And but I think that the solution that would logically follow is actually a solution that has been terrible in terms of fighting what we currently think of as terrorism, and will be even worse if it's applied more broadly.
There are a lot of people, though, who feel like, okay, maybe there won't be NRA giving up all it stands for after the word is used, but by not using the word terrorism, aren't you diffusing the tragedy and kind of, I mean, it's just one of those things that we are going to have to shake our head about instead of something we can do something about if we rethink where power lies in society.
See, I don't think that the word terrorism helps with that. Of course, we're terrorized as a result of the mass shooting, right? But the fact that we're terrorized doesn't mean that an act of terror was committed. And I don't think we benefit from calling it terrorism. And in fact, as I said, I think it actually can do more harm than good.
Aren't you willing to accommodate a certain evolution to the meaning of the word terrorism or terrorist? I mean, when I started out in journalism, it was forbidden, essentially. I mean, the BBC had it was a very toxic word at the BBC because of its relations to the troubles in Northern Ireland.
Absolutely. Language evolves, right? But I think that we as journalists or, you know, as citizens, when we're urging language to evolve, we really have to think seriously about what direction it's going in, right? And words, you know, words never mean exactly one thing. And even when they do mean one thing, it's, you know, they're used to mean its opposite all the time. I mean, language is a very complicated thing. So my argument has to do with both the word, but also what it stands for in our society, right? Mm. In our society, it stands for a very particular political force that has really been shaping a lot of American politics for the last 16 years. And that force, I think, is toxic. Not the word terrorism is toxic, but the force is toxic. The whole idea of the war on terrorism has been destructive to the fabric of American society. The fact that it has led us into a forever war, the fact that it has created a parallel track in the judicial system with inflated sentences and with, you know, very frightening to me prosecutorial rhetoric of treating terrorists as enemy combatants. And that has to do with my final point, which is that calling somebody a terrorist actually elevates them, right? When I covered the Boston Marathon bombing trial here in Boston, I remember being struck by this repeatedly, that here was this guy who had attacked people at random, and he had committed a heinous crime, but he was not being treated as a criminal. He was being treated as an enemy combatant, which to him, I think, felt aggrandizing and, you know, almost glorifying. I don't want to glorify the Las Vegas shooter, right? I think that we should treat the crime as heinous. We should certainly address the availability of guns, and we shouldn't try to imbue the violence with meaning.
There's also this critique of this kind of semantical trick that happens every time one of these horrible events happens, that, you know, there's a sense that white men are lone wolves and everybody else is a terrorist. It helps to kind of equalize the ground for all people with these high-powered guns, right?
Look, I don't think that injustice spread more fairly becomes any more just. And because our ways of fighting what we call terrorism are so horrible and so, I will say the word, un-American, right? If we start applying them to white men, it will feel better for a minute. Because, of course, it's mind-bogglingly horrifying that these particular judicial practices and extrajudicial practices are applied only to brown people. Mm. But after it feels better for a minute, we will just have more use of things that we shouldn't use in the first place.
Masha Gessen with The New Yorker. This is a fascinating discussion, and congratulations on your new book being named a 2017 National Book Award finalist.
Thank you very much.
Some writers have no problem with the word terrorism, like the writers at the French magazine Charlie Hebdo. The word terrorism, not to mention a whole bunch of other controversial words and cartoons, are all fair game for Charlie Hebdo. You'll recall this is the satirical magazine whose offices were attacked by gunmen in early 2015. 12 people were killed, including some of the magazine's best-known cartoonists. Charlie Hebdo is well known in France, less so here, and if you're not French, the idea that a magazine of cartoons could attract such hatred might be baffling. You will get the chance to know Charlie Hebdo a little better now, though. Today, Charlie Hebdo launches a special online American edition. The world is lucky to have Carol Hills following satire around the globe. Carol is in Paris today, where she's been reading that new U.S. version of Charlie Hebdo. So I know you got to speak with the cartoonist behind the American edition, Laurent Suriceau. He's known by his pen name, Rhys. Did you do this interview at the offices of Charlie Hebdo, the ones that were attacked a couple of years ago?
No, absolutely not. They're in a secret location. Really, no one knows where they are except the people who work there. I met Rhys at their publicist's office in Paris. He showed up with security guards. They're with him all the time. He was injured in the 2015 attack, and you know, he watched his colleagues and friends get murdered. I mean, it's really awful. And so he hasn't been without security since then. He says he can't, you know, walk the streets. He can't go anywhere by himself. He also said it makes him sort of double down. I mean, he's both more pessimistic, but also more invigorated about the importance of a magazine like Charlie Hebdo. I mean, here's what he said.
We managed to keep this newspaper alive, and in spite of terrorists trying to silence it, we managed to be even more provocative and more productive than before. You want to be even more alive than before, so you become more productive and more inventive in order to do so.
And one of those projects that Charlie Hebdo is taking on is other editions. They had a German edition, and now they have this special American edition. It's limited. It's just going to be in four parts, and it's only online. And they released the first chapter today.
And what is the American edition about? Like, what are they focusing on?
It's called Feeling the Burn, The American Left Under Trump. And yes, it's partly a reference to Bernie Sanders. But Rees told me that he was really curious about leftist politics in America, especially after the socialist candidate was completely defeated in the last French presidential election. So Rees and this American journalist, Jacob Hamburger, spent several weeks traveling around the U.S. talking to people, and they didn't go for the big names like Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. They really went to the grassroots level, and they visited people working on different aspects of leftist politics, from immigrant rights to union organizing. And then Rees came up with sketches, kind of comics journalism about people working on the left.
So with this sketchbook kind of oral history style, I get the sense that we're not going to see these in-your-face kind of cartoons that Charlie Hebdo is known for, the ones that generate so much controversy. Am I right?
You're completely right. And I was really surprised by this. It's very tame. And part of me wonders whether Americans will be really interested, because it really feels like an expository exercise for Rees. But of course, I had to ask Rees about some of the outrage their cartoons have caused. You know, only recently there was that one about Hurricane Harvey flooding Texas, and this was a cartoon by Rees, and it showed Nazi flags and raised Heil Hitler arms drowning in the floods in Texas, and the caption said, "God exists. He drowned out all of the neo-Nazis in Texas." And I asked him, you know, geez, it's pretty provocative and heartless, and here's his response.
It's not making fun of the suffering of regular folks caught in the storm. This is about two conflating news events, a climate one and a political one. We saw the surge of the far right and neo-Nazi movements in the South, like Charlottesville. We're finding out those people are free to walk around, and because we assume many far right people are very religious, we use an ironic slant to say, yes, God exists, and he drowned you all. It's supposed to crack a joke at the expense of neo-Nazis.
Carol, did you ask Rees about some cartoons in Charlie Hebdo that have been criticized as Islamophobic?
I certainly did. There was one just a few months ago after the terror attack in Barcelona, and the Charlie Hebdo cover cartoon headline on August 23rd was Islam, Religion of Peace, Eternal Peace, you know, as in death. And there was just a storm of criticism. Lots of people really felt the cartoon was Islamophobic. So I asked Rees about it.
We follow our own philosophical beliefs. We think that there's a stereotypical discourse about Islam represented by this catchphrase, Islam, Religion of Peace. So we gave that phrase an ironic slant in the headline because it sounds like a superficial commercial tagline. The idea is to encourage a conversation about the issues that exist within Islam. And I don't think it's being Islamophobic to just want to ask those important questions.
He really digs in, and this is kind of the crux of the issue. He feels like they do not single out Islam, that Charlie Hebdo is equal opportunity offensive, and that they take issue with other major religions, especially religious texts and teachings. But he insists this is not about people and their beliefs. You know, he says in a democracy, everyone has the right to practice a religion, and Charlie Hebdo respects that right, but we also have the right to question what all religions claim, starting with the claims that God exists and everything that stems from that.
So I'm really curious, this whole free expression at any cost tone in Charlie Hebdo and among its writers, it can be confusing for people who don't know this magazine. But after speaking with Rees, did you come away with a better understanding of what Charlie Hebdo is all about?
I did, but I also came away feeling like they're demanding a lot on the part of people who read the newspaper and see the cartoons. Because it's very French, really thinky, all these layers, and they're cartoons that they and lots of people like to talk about. But the way I and most people experience cartoons is that you glance at them and they have an impact. But I have a lot of respect for him, and I came away really respecting Charlie Hebdo and understanding its French context. Not loving all the cartoons and still thinking it's needlessly provocative, but I found, you know, I do respect what they're doing.
The World Satire editor, Carol Hill, speaking with us from Paris. Thanks very much, Carol.
Thanks, Marco.
If you're curious about Charlie Hebdo's special online American edition, we have a link on our Facebook page. Just search for The World. Who betrayed Anne Frank and her family? An FBI veteran takes on his toughest cold case yet. That's just ahead here on The World.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Believe it or not, we still don't know everything there is to know about Anne Frank, specifically how she and her family ended up detained during World War II.
Of all the cases that I've done in my career, 35 years total law enforcement, this will be the most meaningful, but also the most challenging.
Veteran FBI agent Vince Pankoke took on the puzzle after he retired. If you haven't read The Diary of Anne Frank in a while, remember that she was just a teenager in 1944 when German police raided the place where the Franks and another Jewish family had been hiding for 2 years. What Anne Frank's diary does not tell us is how the Nazis found them. Did they stumble upon their hiding place, or were the Franks betrayed? That's what the former FBI agent is trying to find out. And since we like hearing first-person voices here on The World, we got Vince Pankoke to tell us why he launched his own investigation into the Frank family cold case.
I have always been keen on World War II history. I have a tie to it. My father and his three brothers all served in World War II in the military. My father and one of his brothers actually were in Europe. And his group liberated a camp in southern Germany near outside of Mittenwald. So I've always been interested in World War II history. But in 2005, I was working with colleagues in the Netherlands. We drove past the Anne Frank house. And it was at that time that they pointed to the house and informed me that the circumstances surrounding the arrest have never been solved. Well, that never left me. It wasn't something I was planning on doing in retirement. But whenever I received a call from one of the Dutch colleagues in the spring of last year saying that they wanted me to head a team, a cold case team of investigators to investigate it, I couldn't pass it up.
So others have tried to solve this mystery in the past. Going into this investigation, what were some of the theories or conclusions others before you had made?
Well, there were two official investigations by the Dutch government, one after the war, 1947, before the story of Anne Frank was ever known to anybody, and then also in 1963. Both of those investigations focused on a warehouseman who worked in the building and was very suspicious of what may be going on in the rest of the building that he didn't have access to. He would actually lay traps out. He would sprinkle flour on the floor or put pencils on the edge of desks to see if at night people came down out of that area he didn't have access to and would give him a clue to what was going on there. That's one of the main suspects that I described from the first investigations. Both investigations, though, were very limited in scope. They were very focused on this person instead of looking at other possibilities. And as a result, it was inconclusive.
Yeah. So what are you doing differently to solve this case? I mean, you've got like a big team of detectives and data analysts looking into this with you.
We do. One of the things that is a modern investigative police technique is to ask the public for help. So on our website, we have a portal where people will be able to submit information, tips, clues. Because what we're finding is the second and third generations out from World War II are more willing to talk about what happened or what they've heard from their family members. We've already received hundreds of tips, several of which are from family members of suspects that have been named in previous investigations. And we're excited to sit down and talk with them. Of course, telling them, since it is such a sensitive subject, this is not about putting blame on anyone. Mm. It's merely about a search for the truth.
In addition to the crowdsourcing, what else are you doing that's innovative in this investigation?
Well, we're using modern artificial intelligence, which is taking all of the pieces of information that we can find going back over the years, archived information, NSB lists, which is the Dutch Nazi Party lists, collaborator lists, informant lists of the Nazis that I found at our U.S. archives. We're putting all of this information along with genealogy connections into an artificial intelligence database, and it is spitting out information to us right now that is giving us great leads. And I'll tell you, Marco, that has also allowed us to solve several other betrayals of people whose names are
on that.
Yeah. Of course, the people are passed away, so we're going to be looking for perhaps grandchildren or even nieces or nephews. But to inform them that we now know the Dutch policeman who assisted the Gestapo We have records that they were paid a reward for actually finding these people and turning them in. And we know the informants that these Dutch police officers used, the Amsterdam police officers used at that time period. So if there was not closure in their mind, we're going to be able to do that. We're hoping to do it for the Anne Frank case and the others who were in the annex. No guarantee of that, but a byproduct of what we're doing with the artificial intelligence database is we've actually come up with some betrayals that we can solve.
Are you going back through the pages of Anne Frank's diary as part of this investigation? If you are, what's that experience like under these particular circumstances?
It is so different than I remember reading it whenever I was in elementary school. The information that I am getting out of it, she actually documents history of the war as we go through those more than 2 years that she was in hiding. So it is actually for us, we've been using it as sort of a compass needle on which direction to go as far as what was happening in the neighborhood at that time as the people in hiding saw it.
For you, what's been the most surprising finding in this investigation? Like, is there an anecdote you've heard that you believe suggests a promising path to solving this mystery?
Yes, I have. I have been told since I've been researching this that all of the Dutch Nazi records, the Gestapo records, the German Gestapo records were destroyed in a bombing that happened November 26th of 1944. And there is record of the bombing. I've seen pictures of the building and it was quite destroyed. However, what's promising to me is even though we've been told that, I've actually found records that people have told me do not exist from the Amsterdam Gestapo group. Many of them are water and fire damaged, which gives me an indication that they were in that building.
Vince, I'm curious, if you solve this case, is it more than just putting a mystery to rest? What would the significance be of a betrayal for this particular family, the Franks?
I think that we can all agree that the story of Anne Frank represents the story of all people who experienced the Holocaust, all of the Jews who were hiding and captured in Holland. The Anne Frank name is attached to it because she actually documented it. It was printed and has been written about and talked about all over the world. But it's just not about Anne Frank and the seven others. It's about all of those people that were betrayed or experienced the Holocaust. Mm. To me, that is very, very important. And we have a motto on the team, and that there is no statute of limitations on the truth. Doesn't matter how long it takes, we're going to try to solve this.
No statute of limitations on the truth. Can I borrow that from time to time?
You can absolutely do it.
That was Vince Pankoke, retired FBI agent, speaking with us from Florida. Still ahead, another first-person voice. A BBC reporter describes his former life as a diamond miner. That's here, only on The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The World in Words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The World in Words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. 60 years ago today, it was a sound from space heard round the world.
It was something which reached a massive population because of that little beep. It made the point. It was a brilliant exercise.
The legacy of a little Soviet satellite called Sputnik. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Relations between the U.S. and Cuba have definitely hit a speed bump. It started with those reports that American diplomats in Havana got sick from mysterious sonic attacks. The State Department blames Cuba for not protecting them. Now it's kicking 15 Cubans out of Washington, and Cuba says that's unacceptable. Here's how my BBC colleague Will Grant, who covers Cuba, sums it up.
So you've got the United States saying that Cuba needs to do more to protect its diplomatic staff while it's on Cuban soil, and the Cubans saying that the decision by Washington was hasty, that the State Department hadn't provided, in their words, a shred of evidence as to the harm caused to those diplomats in these alleged attacks, that Cuban doctors haven't had access to either the victims or the medical staff treating them, that there have been obstacles all the way through. They haven't been able to access the homes that they were supposedly attacked in. So, you know, it's become a really difficult situation diplomatically, politically, because you have one side saying, well, you need to stop these attacks, and the other side saying, well, what attacks?
Well, there has been fertile ground for this tiff between Havana and Washington. It is Trump now, not Obama. And back in June, President Trump announced a plan to cool relations between the U.S. and Cuba. And at the time, he unveiled new restrictions on travel and business with the island. So do you think this latest move by the State Department is part of that earlier plan?
Well, if we look at the timings, the first attacks, in alleged attacks, took place around the time that President Trump was elected, so November. It's hard to say, of course, to what extent the two things are related, but it does obviously build into a wider story of hostility. You remember the speech by President Trump in Florida, really appealing to the lowest common denominator of the Cuban-American anti-Castro lobby. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida has been pushing that agenda, continue the U.S. economic embargo on the island, deepen sanctions, pull back on the warming of relations seen under Barack Obama. You know, all of that's been happening, and then we add this on top, and it is an extremely complicated situation.
Yeah, the reality looks like it's a weakening of U.S.-Cuban relations right now, and I guess I just want to ask you, how could Cuba be affected by that?
Well, right now, in a number of ways. First and foremost, with two-thirds of U.S. staff in the U.S. embassy in Havana gone, that means that no more visas will be issued for the time being to Cubans trying to come to the United States. That makes it extremely difficult, of course, for those families to see each other. Vice versa, Cuban consular services will be heavily hit in Washington. That's going to make life difficult for families on the other side of the Florida Straits. And of course, the new travel advice that the State Department has given to Americans with regard to Cuba specifically states that they warn against travel because they can't guarantee their safety there. Most ordinary Cubans are horrified at that idea. They hold their country's security very high. They're very proud of the fact that visitors are safe when they come to Cuba, which isn't true of the rest of the region always, and they're very proud of that. The idea that the new travel advice is simply don't go and visit Cuba because we can't look after you, or we can't guarantee that you'll be okay while you're there, based on the fact that more than 20 diplomats, not tourists or visitors of any other description, have been targeted allegedly by these sonic attacks, seems to them a huge overreaction, and of course one that will impact those small businesses, the entrepreneurs that President Trump says he wants to help. So, you know, there is a lot of ill feeling created on the streets, not just among the Cuban government over this.
Will Grant covers Cuba for our partners at the BBC. Will, thank you very much.
Very welcome, Marco.
Remember the assassination of Kim Jong-un's half-brother, Kim Jong-nam? It happened a few months ago. Really weird story. It all went down in the airport in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And when it happened, it all seemed really suspicious. Kim Jong-nam had been approached by two women in the airport who rubbed some mysterious goo on his face. And almost immediately, he died. What was most suspicious was those two women. Who were they? Some secretive female assassin force? Well, the truth is a lot more banal and sordid, but it also makes more sense. It's uncovered in a great piece of reporting in GQ by Doug Bach Clark. Just connect the dots for us, if you would, Doug. Who are these two women?
These two women were not professional assassins. They were two farm girls, one from Indonesia and one from Vietnam. For one of the women, for Siti Aisha, she was born in a very, very small, very rural village on the island of Java. And she grew up in a very religious, very Islamic environment. But as she grew, she saw that the capital, Jakarta, was modernizing, that people there were having a much better standard of living. And so when she was in her very early teens, she moved there and ended up working in a sweatshop. And that was the first of many steps that she took to lead a more economically upward life. And Doan Thi Huong, the Vietnamese woman, she was also born in a rural village, moved to Hanoi, the capital of Vietnam, in her teens in order to try and find work, and was eventually drawn into sex work, during which she was recruited by the North Koreans with promises of becoming a star.
Who recruited her, and were you able to trace those lines back to Pyongyang?
Yes. So both Siti Aisha, the Indonesian woman, and Don, the Vietnamese woman, were recruited by North Korean agents pretending to be Japanese and Chinese TV producers. They pretended that they were making a prank TV show in which pretty women smeared liquids on the face of unsuspecting victims. And they told Siti and Don that they would be paid $100 for every time they did this. And over the course of over a month, they trained them to smear people who looked like Kim Jong-nam. So they would take them to a mall or the airport, and they would point out people who looked like Kim Jong-nam, and they would put baby oil or sriracha on Siti's hands and then tell her to go smear the person. And she believed that she was being filmed on hidden camera. And they did this in situations that were similar to the final assassination.
I mean, it really seems the enticement was, I'm going to make you a star, which is no different from the promises made to so many young starlets who have gotten off the bus in Los Angeles. But were they really duped, or do you think they knew what was going on and are still acting otherwise?
According to my reporting, it seems that they were duped. And while that might seem unlikely that someone would be so unaware of what was going on, it's important to remember that Siti did not graduate from middle school. She did not speak English or Korean. She did not even understand the difference between North Korea and South Korea. However, a trial has just begun in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And it's possible that the Malaysian government has some evidence like email chains or social media messaging between them and the North Koreans.
I just want to go back to the line of succession in North Korea, which I think is kind of key here. So Kim Jong-nam, the man who was assassinated in the airport, was going to be the heir to the throne. That would have been Kim Jong-il when he died. Remind us why he was passed over and why Kim Jong-un got to be the new leader.
So Kim Jong-nam was the oldest son, and so would theoretically have been in line to become the leader of the dictatorship after his father passed, until in his early 20s, in the early 2000s, he tried to sneak into Japan using a fake passport. And when he was caught by Japanese authorities, he said that he wanted to go to Disneyland, to Tokyo Disneyland, which strongly embarrassed his father to have an heir who was so immature. And he was subsequently pushed to the side, and his younger brother and the current ruler of North Korea was elevated in his place.
Is there a connection between this story of this assassination of Kim Jong-nam and North Korea's current nuclear saber-rattling?
Very much so. The same signal is being sent by rubbing this chemical weapon on Kim Jong-nam's face. If you really just wanted to kill Kim Jong-nam, you could have shot him. You could have used any of the other more normal methods of assassination. But the weapon that the women used was called VX, listed by the CDC as one of the most deadly chemical compounds in the world. It's considered a weapon of mass destruction. And North Korea was trying to show that if someone were to try and invade North Korea, or if Trump was to try and assassinate Kim Jong-un, there could be serious consequences like the release of VX on civilians.
Doug Bock-Clark, who wrote the story about the assassination of Kim Jong-nam in GQ magazine, thank you very much for telling us about your reporting.
Thanks, Marco.
A story from our Across Women's Lives desk now about what can happen after natural disasters hit. First, there's a scramble for survival, for things like food, water, and first aid. Then comes the rebuilding. But law enforcement worries about something else as well, the human trafficking that comes in the wake of all the destruction. The world's Jasmine Garst reports from Houston.
Pretty girls wanting to make some quick money and recover losses from Harvey. That's an online ad I came across recently in Houston, one of many mentioning the hurricane. Now, in the past, I had heard about traffickers targeting natural disaster areas, so I reached out to someone who knows all about the world of sex trafficking.
Here, I was gang trafficked over here. Majority of the Crips run this area. There's a few Bloods a little further north.
Allison Franklin is a sex trafficking survivor and an advocate for victims of trafficking. Tonight, we're driving around Houston right after Hurricane Harvey. Her car is creaky, and she drives with the window open, letting the hot breeze in. These are the streets where she herself was once sold and bought.
These cheap motels, I mean, these are hotbeds for trafficking and prostitution and drugs. I lived in this hotel for about 3 years.
In the darkness, under a yellow streetlight, a very young woman in a baggy dress stands looking out at nothing in particular. On the next corner, another girl, and another one, waiting to get picked up. A lot of these girls, Franklin says, are trafficked by the gangs that rule this area, just like she was. She remembers working around 2006 when women started showing up from New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina.
So many individuals flooded just this area alone that I know of that were homeless. They had no money. They had no place to live. And so you're not left with many options when you're in that situation.
It's difficult to put numbers on an underground industry like sex trafficking. But we do know it's a trade that moves millions of dollars every year.
I just know that a market's a market.
Former Congresswoman Linda Smith of Washington State is the founder of the anti-trafficking NGO Shared Hope International.
And if there's somebody that's going to pay good money, lots of money, somebody else is going to bring a product to that market. And unfortunately, a natural disaster like we've seen will bring a market just because of market principles.
I called Smith up so she could explain how this all works. She says you get thousands of workers, mostly men, and aid workers flooding in to rebuild a city. And you mix that with a population that has just lost everything. Smith says she first came into contact with these cases following natural disasters in Asia, but then she noticed them here in the U.S. too.
Girls who had been trafficked by a major trafficking ring across the upper part of the country, but they were dropping into the Katrina area. Now, what shocked me when I started talking to some of the girls is they looked at me like, well, yeah, because that's where you go, because there's a lot of buyers.
And it wasn't just women from other states. Local women were being sold, too.
Yeah. Local is your vulnerable population who's out there. We know a lot of them are out there. And now they're more destabilized. And the systems around them are destabilized for a period of time. And so it just simply makes them right for the picking.
Before the hurricane, the Houston police was concerned enough to speak throughout communities about the dangers of trafficking after a disaster. Back in the car, Allison Franklin says she's worried about the same dynamics happening here in Houston.
One of those guys is a pimp.
She's pointing to a group of guys hanging out under the pulsating light of a gas station. Her former pimp is probably out here somewhere, too. She's seen him around.
Bottom feeder pimps, they sit out there on that corner and wait for the women to come back with money and then give them drugs and send them back out again.
But this is the lowest rung of the ladder, the bottom of the barrel. Franklin remembers working out here when something changed. The internet. She remembers her own trafficker started moving girls off the street. She says the internet is a sex trafficker's dream come true.
It lowered the risks of, say, the trafficker or the women getting caught.
And think about it in this disaster context. Your life was upended by a hurricane. Maybe you lost your home, your car. But you probably still have your phone. You may still go online. Franklin consults for a Texas nonprofit, Children at Risk. They did a study recently and found that adult ads on online sites doubled after Hurricane Harvey.
And they still haven't gone down yet.
Adult ads don't equal trafficking. And plenty of people choose to be sex workers. When I get back to my hotel, I go online and check out those ads again. It's hard not to cringe at the ones that imply sex in exchange for shelter after the hurricane. When everything has been lost, choice becomes a vague term. If you lost your house, one man offers a large place to stay. He'll take care of you, as long as you're Hispanic, Asian, or white, and in good shape. Send pictures. Are these genuine offers for willing participants or traffickers, sweet-talking the most vulnerable? All you have to do to find out is hit reply.
Wow, that was the world's Jasmine Garis reporting from Houston for our Across Women's Lives desk. Everybody's got a backstory, don't you know? And our partners at the BBC, they've got a lot of backstories. My colleague Omaru Fofana is originally from Sierra Leone. He's done some incredibly brave reporting out of West Africa in the past few years. His work during the Ebola outbreak, for example. But before today, I had no idea that Omaru was once a diamond miner. He told his story to David Amanor, host of the BBC's Fifth Floor podcast.
I took to mining in between my times, either on holiday or on the weekend. I would mine for a diamond. And
is this diamond digging going on in a riverbed?
It is going on in a riverbed. That's basically what we do. We kind of like dig deep for the gravel. Sometimes the gravel is mud. It's very muddy, solid clay kind of stuff. We call that ballop in our local language. I'm not sure if that's an English word. On some of the occasions, we'd go for the dry, red, tropical gravel, which would carry in sacks, you know, from the dry, solid ground to somewhere with some presence of water to be able to wash the gravel and wash the mud off it.
So is it hard work?
Very, very hard work, David. Really very hard. My palms were almost always blistered because of the hard work using the pickaxe to dig for it or even using the shovel to extract the gravel and clearly using even the sieve. I mean, my fingernails would almost always break. I could hardly feel if something touched my fingers because, I mean, they were almost always in constant touch with rocks, with sand, with stones, with the sieve. Clearly very, very hard work to do. And carrying the dry, brown, tropical gravel also meant that my neck and my head were almost always paining me.
And what did you find?
Eventually, after my high school leaving exam, I was able to get something around 2 carats together with two of my fellow gang members, as we are called. Mm-hmm. That's the lingo used in the mining areas for those who come together to mine. So we're able to find a diamond and we sold it and I managed to get my own share. And that's how I partially funded my university education.
So this little diamond, this 2-carat diamond, did you know immediately when you picked it up, when you found it, that it was worth something?
I had an idea as to what a diamond looked like. So I was actually down knee-deep, probably waist-deep in the water with my sieve, washing the gravel, which had been put into the sieve by one of my colleagues using a shovel. I saw a sparkling stone just when the sieve was under the water. So I quickly brought up the sieve, and then it turned out to be a diamond. So I had this huge heartbeat. My heart really, you know, pounded rather unusually and very fast. And then I whispered to one of my colleagues and said, "Na diamond, it's a diamond." That's in the local Creole language. And I picked it up, put it inside my mouth, and we literally just threw away all our working tools and jumped into the very tall grass in the swampy area, and we found our way into mainland Tongo. So I come, went and sold the diamond, and I got my share. At the time, it was sold for 100,000 leons. I'm not sure how much that translated then into dollars. I gave it to my aunt to add to her capital, which eventually turned out to be the key to me entering university. At the very least, I was able to pay my first year fees, and that's how the doors kept opening throughout college.
That was my colleague, reporter Omaru Fofana. He was speaking with David Amanor of the BBC's Fifth Floor podcast. And finally, 60 years ago today, a new era dawned. That's the Sputnik beep, the radio signal sent by the first satellite ever launched. Sputnik, of course, was the Soviet Union's entry into the space race. And that signal could be picked up across the world. And we're talking a satellite about the size of a beach ball. Doug Millard is the curator of the London Science Museum's recent cosmonaut exhibition. What was the significance of Sputnik, Doug?
It's where all of the space age started. So people were expecting it to happen, particularly in America. The big surprise, though, that it was Sputnik. It was the Soviet Union that launched first.
Right. So the U.S. had not started its Mercury missions yet or launched any of its own satellites. Was it a shock to the Americans that the Soviets kind of got up into the skies first?
Well, on the one hand, it wasn't a shock. This was the time of the Eisenhower administration, and he was fairly relaxed about it because, apart from anything else, it set a precedent for overflying one's neighbor's territories. However, politically, the fallout was immense, and gradually it became clear that you could not have the US being second. And, of course, things started to move slowly but surely, and we know what it led to.
I mean, at the time, I imagine Sputnik must have seemed very Jules Verne for a lot of people. Did it kind of capture people's imaginations?
Well, it did. And interestingly, it sort of delivered on the visions of many decades earlier, you know, 1920s, 1930s, when people in the US, in Soviet Union and Europe, they were imagining about going into space. Jules Verne, probably one of the most significant influences on the early thinkers. So when Sputnik happened, it was the future delivered. Science fiction was becoming science fact.
How did the rest of the world receive the news of the launch of Sputnik?
Well, it was a global phenomenon. There was as much interest over here in the UK and in Europe. It was something which reached a massive population because of that little beep that you played at the beginning. It could be picked up by amateur radio stations, and it was everywhere. It was broadcast over the airwaves. It made the point. It was a brilliant exercise.
And for the Soviets, was it a moment of pride, or was it kind of like, fine, we're in space, but I got to go get in the breadline?
Oh, no, this was huge pride. 1957, just over a decade after the end of the war, so much suffering. So Sputnik was achieving tremendous national pride for the Soviet Union, only to be eclipsed by Gagarin a few years later. More crowds in Red Square than at the end of the Second World War. So we can't underestimate the pride, which continues to this day.
Yeah, and then 12 years after Sputnik, Neil Armstrong was on the moon with the U.S. Apollo mission. Why do you think space exploration seems to have slowed down, or at least not been so focused on these celebrity rockets and astronauts?
Well, some of us can remember certainly most of the 60s.
I do too.
Oh, good. So we sometimes forget this, the amazing rate. Now, of course, once NASA was created and got into gear, it motored at the most astonishing rate. And Kennedy pledged that the U.S. would land a man on the moon by the end of the decade. He said that in 1961. They'd achieved it by 1969. The rate of space spectaculars was astonishing. And I think it was inevitable that it would plateau out after that. And in many ways, we're still on that plateau.
That's Doug Millard, the curator of the London Science Museum's recent cosmonaut exhibition, helping us to remember Sputnik, which launched 60 years ago today. Doug, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
And we leave things today on that plateau. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back for another Orbit Round Your World tomorrow. We'll see you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.